Okay. Well, yeah, thank you for inviting me to talk. And thank you for everyone for coming to listen. And I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. I have to be in Southampton tomorrow, so it couldn't work. But so what I'll be talking about is in this paper that I've put the archive number up for. And it's about some work I've done on the emergence of a classical phase space in quantum gravity, and to be specific, in holography. So I'm sure most people here know, but just to quickly run through what holography is, we have a D plus one dimensional theory with gravity and a D dimensional theory without gravity. And holography says that these things are dual in some way. And when I talk about holography in this talk, I'll almost always mean ADS CFT. So in this case, the gravity theory lives on an asymptotically ADS space-time, and the CFT is the boundary theory that lives on the boundary of that space-time. We call the gravity theory the bulk and the boundary theory the boundary. So most research stemming from the discovery of holography and the holographic principle can be loosely sorted into two categories. And the first one involves using holography to sort of answer a hard question on one side by translating it into an easy question on the other side. And the way this is done is by using the dictionary, the holographic dictionary, which tells us how to do this translation. And then the other main avenue is to write new entries in the dictionary. And by doing this, we can understand holography better, and also we can do things in the first category more widely. And these two categories, they complement each other, and often you can't distinguish between them. So recently, a particular section of the holographic dictionary has emerged, and it's taken the name subregion duality, and it relates locality in the two theories. So if we have some subregion in the boundary, call it A, then there's some subregion in the bulk, which is dual to A. In the sense that any question we could ask about this boundary subregion can be rephrased as some question about the dual subregion in the bulk, and vice versa. So the current consensus is that the dual subregion is the entanglement wedge, and I'll construct that now. So we think of the boundary subregion as a partial Cauchy surface, or we could alternatively think of it as the domain of dependence in the boundary of this partial Cauchy surface. And then we take the extremal area surface in the bulk, which is homologous to that partial Cauchy surface, and we call it A. I'll call it epsilon. And then because these two surfaces are homologous, there is a codimension one surface in the bulk that interpolates between them, which I'll call sigma. And then the entanglement wedge is just the domain of dependence of sigma. So it's worth briefly running through why the entanglement wedge is believed to be the correct subregion. And historically, the first evidence for this was the Wadariya-Takinagi conjecture and the Hubany-Rangamani-Takinagi conjectures, which said that the area of epsilon, that extremal surface, gives at leading order the entanglement entropy of the state in A. And then Faulkner, Lukacs, and Maurasena, they showed that there are quantum corrections to this coming from fluctuations of the bulk fields in the entanglement wedge, which led Jeffress, Lukacs, Maurasena, and Sue to suggest that this extends to a complete duality between the states in A and the state in the entanglement wedge. And this was made very precise by Dong, Harlow, and Wall, who showed that any bulk operator localized inside of the entanglement wedge can be reconstructed as a boundary operator acting in the boundary region A. And there are many other developments in this part of the dictionary, and they all support this idea, and there's too many to go into. But in this talk, I'll give my own new entry in this section of the dictionary. So to explain this, we consider the classical limit of the bulk gravity theory. So in the boundary, this often corresponds to taking the rank of the gauge group N to be very large. Because this is a classical limit, we should get a phase space, a classical phase space, and Poisson brackets on that phase space. And mathematically speaking, this is a symplectic manifold. So this is a manifold P. Each point in the manifold is a classical field configuration. And the manifold also comes with a symplectic form, which is a closed and non-degenerate two form. And this form is what gives us the Poisson brackets. So locally, we can write it in the form I've shown there, where Q and P are conjugate variables. And we can invert this form to get the Poisson brackets. I'm going to be talking about the phase space of a field theory, because at large n, the bulk gravity theory can be approximated as a field theory. So I should tell you how we construct the phase space for such a thing. So if we have a theory of fields, call them phi, and they have this action, which is the integral of some Lagrangian density form, and we consider a linear variation of the fields, phi going to phi plus delta phi, then the variation of the Lagrangian can in general be written in this way. So the first term on the right-hand side is just the equations of motion, but there's also another term, which is the exterior derivative of some form. And phase space is the space of solutions to the equations of motion. And we use theta to construct the symplectic structure. So we take a Cauchy surface, sigma. We integrate theta over that surface to get this object, capital theta. And because delta phi is a linearized variation of a solution to the equations of motion, we can view it as a vector on the space of solutions. And theta depends linearly on that vector, so it's a one form on P. And then if we take the exterior derivative of theta, that's what we define to be the symplectic form. And it turns out that this symplectic form is exactly the one that we want because it replicates all of the expected Poisson brackets for the theory.
I mean, at the top of the, if you go back one slide, at the top of the slide, delta phi was in variation. But you,
right.
I guess towards the bottom, that it's actually a solution of the linearized equations. So you're only doing variation from one solution to another, is that right?
Right, yeah. So I can consider theta as a one form on the whole space of solutions to the equations of motion, which I can then pull back to the space of solutions. In terms of the phase space itself, delta phi has to be a variation from one solution to the other to another. So it has to solve the linearized equations of motion. But that's just because the phase space is defined in such a way that.
But that's the context in which I should think that we're. It's a delta phi on the phase space.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Maybe I should have put that. Okay. Right. So there's a result due to Alex Belin, Aito Lukowicz, and Gabor Sarosi, which applies to the case of a field theory on an asymptotically ADS spacetime. Which is holographically dual to a CDF on CFT on the boundary. And they showed that the symplectic form omega of this covariant phase space is dual to the Berry curvature of the boundary Hilbert space. So I should remind you what Berry curvature is. So we have a Hilbert space. We consider a closed curve of normalized states in that Hilbert space, which I've called C. And we pick some states ordered along C. And we consider the transition amplitude for going from the first state to the second state to the third state, and so on, all the way up to the nth state, and then back to the first state. And this is given by the product of the individual transition amplitudes. And then we consider a limit in which the states that we've picked We take infinitely many of them, and they densely cover the original curve. And then you can show that in this limit, the transition amplitude becomes a pure phase. And gamma, that phase, is the Berry phase. And furthermore, you can show that it takes this form. So C is that curve, and we compute the derivative of the state along it, and then integrate this thing. And you can write that as the integral of a form. And the form A is called the Berry connection. And it's a connection because under the U1 gauge transformation on Hilbert space, where we just take every state and multiply it by some arbitrary phase factor, it transforms like a U1 connection. And the curvature of that connection, given by that formula, that's the Berry curvature. So back to the holographic case, we have in holography there is a relevant set of states are labeled by this parameter lambda, and this tells you how to gives you some operator insertions in the boundary theory, and in the bulk theory it sets the boundary conditions. And in the classical gravity limit, there's a one-to-one map between the boundary conditions and the bulk field configuration, or we assume there is. And then these people showed that if you take the symplectic form for the bulk fields and you pull it back through this map, you get exactly the Berry curvature for these states. So in this talk, I'll generalize this result to subregions. So let sigma be some Cauchy surface for an entanglement wedge. You can use the covariant phase space formalism to give you a symplectic form for the entanglement wedge, modulo some ambiguities, which I'll come back to. And I'll show how to recover this symplectic form by measuring something called the Ullmann phase in the Hilbert space associated with the boundary subregion. And Ullmann phase is a generalization of Berry phase to mixed states. And we have to do something like this because Berry phases are only defined for curves of pure states. And because of entanglement, the state in this boundary subregion is always mixed. So here's the plan for the rest of the talk. I'll tell you what Ullmann phase is exactly. So this will involve defining Ullmann holonomy and the closely related concept of fidelity. And I'll describe a useful theorem due to Ullmann, which can help to in the computation of this Ullmann holonomy. And then I'll apply that to the holographic case. So I'll show how we can compute the Ullmann holonomy using a replica trick. And then I'll show that if you compute this thing called the Ullmann phase, you can recover the symplectic form. And then I'll finish off with some comments and future directions. And if there are any more questions at any time, just feel free to interrupt me. Okay, so let's start with Ullmann holonomy. So first of all, I'll define purifications. So if we have some density matrix acting on a Hilbert space, a purification of that density matrix is a state in some extended Hilbert space such that the reduction of that state to the first Hilbert space H, it gives you the density matrix back. And H prime here is just any auxiliary Hilbert space that we want. So there are many possible purifications for a given density matrix. We could, fixing H prime, we can pick many possible purifications, but we can also change H prime to some other auxiliary Hilbert space. So suppose we measure some system initially in a state rho one, and then at some point later we measure it in a state rho two. And let's assume also that those density matrices arise as reductions of some pure states in a larger system that we believe to actually be the full system. The transition probability between these two purifications is given by the usual formula. And Ullmann's idea is to assume that this probability is maximized. So in the classical regime, because probabilities should be sharply peaked, this is, we can sort of assume this is a good approximation. And purifications that maximize this probability are called parallel. And they're called parallel because they'll give rise to a notion of parallel transport. So there's this theorem due to Ullmann, which says if we have two purifications of two density matrices, they'll be parallel if and only if this equation holds. So the square roots here are just defined in terms of the spectrums of the various positive operators involved, non-negative operators. And the quantity on the left-hand side is called the fidelity. And we can think of it as a generalization of transition amplitude to mixed states. Something else that we should... Yes.
Are you guaranteed that there's a purification that you can achieve this equality? Is that, that's part of the...
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it's really just because all we want to do is maximize this transition probability. And we can always obtain that maximum. I guess so long as the auxiliary Hilbert space is large enough, I suppose we're assuming that it's large enough to permit at least one purification. I think the way the theorem is proved is by constructing a family of purifications with some parameters in there and then maximizing with respect to those parameters. But so long as the auxiliary Hilbert space is large enough, and if it's not, we can always make it larger, then these purifications exist. Okay. So something else to keep in mind is that parallel purifications aren't unique. And so long as one exists, so long as one set of parallel purifications exist, we can always find infinitely many other ones. And that's because if psi 1 and psi 2 are parallel purifications of rho 1 and rho 2, then so are these two states given here. And F1 and F2 are just some phases, and U is some unitary operator, or more generally, it can be an isometry from one auxiliary Hilbert space to another. And the reason that these are also parallel purifications is if we compute the transition probability, they're unaffected by these changes. So now let's suppose we have a complete curve, a complete closed curve of density matrices acting on H. And let's choose some density matrices ordered along this curve, rho 1 up to rho n. And let's assume that we have a purification of each density matrix such that each subsequent pair of density matrices of purifications is parallel, so that the transition probability is maximized. Now we take that the limit as n goes to infinity, and the density matrices densely cover the original curve. Then the states, the purifications psi I will converge to a curve C tilde in H, so long as we choose their phases in a nice way, which can be done. We call this, sorry?
C tilde need not be closed anymore.
Yeah, that yeah, exactly. That's completely right. And I'll have that in the next slide.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so this curve C tilde is called the parallel lift. And it's not unique for the same reason the purifications themselves aren't unique. And as you said, the C tilde doesn't have to be closed, even if C is. So all we're really guaranteed is that the final purification is related to the initial purification by the action of some unitary operator acting on the auxiliary Hilbert space. And so we can think of this construction as we give it this curve, this curve of density matrices, and we get back a unitary operator X. And this is an example of holonomy. And we can think of it this is telling us how to parallelly transport the purification around the curve of density matrices. And because this C-tilde isn't necessarily closed, that's telling us that this holonomy has some curvature. And this curvature really reflects the configuration of the entanglement between the H and H prime, the original Hilbert space and the auxiliary one. So that's the Ullmann holonomy. The Ullmann phase is slightly different. It's just a number we associate with this thing. So we take this a curve, and we take its parallel lift, C tilde, and then we just compute the Berry phase along C tilde. Now this object, this Berry phase is not going to depend on the choice of parallel lift. So it's fine that the parallel lifts C tilde aren't unique, because all of the phase factors and unitary operators will cancel in this transition amplitude. And then gamma on the right is what we call the Ullmann phase of the curve of density matrices. And in the case of a curve of pure states, it just reduces to the Berry phase. So it's a genuine generalization of the Berry phase. Okay, so now get to the main part of the talk, and I want to apply these ideas to holographic theories.
I can ask a quick question.
Yes.
I guess you're viewing this purification as some sort of fiber bundle over this set of density matrices.
Is that right?
Right, and then. So can I just get a canonical one by doubling the size of the Hilbert space, or is there no notion of making a canonical one that'll work for any density matrix?
I mean, I guess there is a canonical purification of any density matrix. I'm not sure that the transition probability between two such canonical purifications will be maximized by those purifications. I think when there is entanglement between H and H prime, so when the density matrices are mixed, there is always curvature in the Ullmann holonomy, which I think in this language means that we can't pick a global section of this bundle or something like that, which means that maybe this isn't possible.
Okay. Yeah, I was more curious about whether the bundle itself is like a well-defined object, or it seemed like I can come up with different ways of constructing that, like forgetting about the connection part. Is that object kind of just well-defined by itself, or are there choices to be made there?
Well, you have to pick the auxiliary Hilbert space, I suppose. If the auxiliary Hilbert space is too small, then I think this bundle doesn't exist, because there's not enough. You're not always going to be guaranteed that you can find a purification of any density matrix. But if the dimension of the auxiliary Hilbert space is larger than the original Hilbert space, I think you can always find purifications. And then I think there's just a recipe you can. I think it's unique after you've done made that choice.
Okay.
But the Ullmann phase and doesn't depend crucially on that auxiliary Hilbert space. So long as it's big enough, it won't depend on what auxiliary Hilbert space you've chosen.
Okay. Josh, since you got interrupted, can you go
yes.
back one slide? Because I have to continue
yes.
to follow. I have a
okay.
I lifted to a C tilde.
Mm-hmm.
That's not closed. So what are the states I'm looking at? Am I just is that last overlap between psi n and psi one? Those aren't necessarily mm-hmm. close to each other anymore, is that right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. It will be.
But I'm still Sorry? Getting a phase that's in this limit.
I think, yeah, you're still getting a phase, but I think in general it will be a complex phase.
Okay.
But in the holographic case, it turns out this phase is always real. And I admit I don't have like a complete intuition for why that's true, but it's convenient that it is, I suppose.
Okay, thank you.
But yes, in general, I think because this curve isn't closed, there'll be some contribution to that phase, some imaginary part, which means that the right hand side of this isn't unital. Okay, right, so I'll apply this to the holographic case. So we can prepare holographic states in ADS-CFT by doing a Euclidean path integral on a half sphere, and this gives us the vacuum. And then we insert operators in that half sphere. So O is meant to denote all possible operators dual to bulk fields. Lambda is some function that sources them. T is time ordering, and then we just integrate over this. And we can get the dual states by carrying out a time reflection and a complex conjugation to the sources lambda. So this notation lambda T is just meant to denote lambda under time reflection. And we compute the inner product of two of these states by gluing together these two manifolds and then doing a path integral over the result. So by gluing together, I mean identifying all of the fields at the two boundaries and then summing over them. And in a large n limit, the holographic dictionary tells us that we can write this path integral in terms of a bulk action, so S. So it's evaluated on the on-shell bulk field configuration, which matches the boundary conditions set by lambda 1 in the Euclidean past and lambda 2 T star in the Euclidean future. So this is a Euclidean bulk action.
Were there any constraints on your sources to make that gluing smooth?
So I think... I'm not sure if I've thought about that. I guess one thing I could say is that maybe you need lambda 1 to equal lambda 2 T star at the boundary. But I'm not sure. I guess I don't want to say we can allow non-smooth boundary conditions, but I haven't really considered that. I guess I'm just assuming that there is some smooth bulk that sort of fills in these boundary conditions. Okay. So to get the state in the subregion, so we pick some subregion A. We factorize the boundary Hilbert space in this way, assuming that this factorization is possible. And then the state in the subregion, given these sources lambda, is defined as the reduced density matrix of the original state lambda. And the denominator here is just there because those states weren't properly normalized. And in terms of a path integral, we can compute the elements of this matrix by doing a path integral over the manifold that we get by gluing the two constituent manifolds along A bar. So suppose we have two such states, row 1 and row 2, given by sources lambda 1 and lambda 2. So I'll define for any complex k this replicated fidelity, where I take the square root of row 1 composed with row 2 composed with the square root of row 1, I take the kth power, and I take the trace. And the usual fidelity is recovered at k equals half. And the way we're going to compute this fidelity is by first computing the replicated fidelity and then continuing back to k equals half. So to do this, I need to prove a little lemma. So the lemma says that this replicated fidelity is analytic in K, and it's absolutely bounded by one for the when the real part of K is greater than or equal to a half. And the way to prove this is to this operator is always non-negative because it can be written as the composition of an operator and its Hermitian conjugate. And that means that the square root of it is of it on the right hand side there. I'm sorry, I would point with my mouse, but I don't think you can see. That right hand side is always going to be non-negative. And in a QFT, so long as the subregion A is a proper subregion, row one and row two will always be invertible because the state in the subregion is faithful. So in fact, this operator is actually positive. It's a strict inequality. And Ullmann's theorem tells us that the trace of the operator is less than or equal to one because it's equal to the inner product of some normalized vectors. And then this tells us that the eigenvalues of this operator have to lie strictly in between zero and one. And then since the replicated fidelity is just a sum of these eigenvalues to the power of 2k, the claim of the lemma is true. So the reason I prove this lemma is we can now use a useful theorem from complex analysis, which tells us that fk is uniquely determined in this range by the values it takes on the positive integers. So the strategy will be to compute fk on the positive integers and then analytically continue back. And when k is a positive integer, the replicated fidelity is easier to compute because the cyclic property of the trace means that we can write fk in terms of the as the expression on the right hand side. And this doesn't involve any square roots, which is very helpful because square roots are sort of density matrices are sort of hard to understand in terms of bulk actions. Okay, so for the states we're considering, we can compute this trace with a path integral. So there are k copies of row one and k copies of row two, and they're interleaved in this way. So we have k copies of each of the manifolds with the sources. And I'll draw these in a slightly different way to make things easier. So I'll peel back the boundaries at A and just draw them like these little wedges. So composing these density matrices one after the other just means that we glue each of these wedges along the boundaries to the next one. And then when we take the trace, we just glue back the first manifold to the last. So I have a series of pictures that shows how this works for k equals 3. So we have three copies of row one, then we have three copies of row two that we interleave with them. Then composing them means we glue them in this way. Taking the trace means we glue the final back to the first. And then the result looks something like this. So this is a boundary manifold with sources inserted in this way. And we do a path integral on this manifold to compute this trace. So at large n, to compute this path integral, we can evaluate a bulk action in terms of some on-shell field configuration. So if I now take a cross section of this diagram along the plane of the slide, we have some red bulk filling in the blue boundary. And the boundary conditions have some symmetries. So there's this symmetry that I'll call T bar, which reflects along a certain copy of A bar in the boundary and also takes the complex conjugates of the sources. So this is an exact symmetry. And we also have a replica symmetry, which is a ZK, which just cyclically moves around these individual replicas of the original boundary manifolds. Now, when the sources for one of the density matrices is approximately equal to the sources for the other density matrices, we get some more symmetries that approximately hold. So we get this another type of reflection symmetry, which I'll call T, which reflects along the copies of A. And we also, the replica symmetry ZK is enhanced to a Z2K replica symmetry, which cyclically permutes the boundary conditions half as much. So we can use these symmetries to decompose the bulk field configuration. So there'll be some codimension 2 surface in the bulk, which is fixed by the replica symmetry. And we also use the T and T bar reflection symmetries to construct 4K codimension 1 surfaces, which extend from the boundary to this surface epsilon. So 2K of them will intersect the boundary at A, the copies of A, and the other 2K will intersect it at the copies of A bar. And I'll call the ones which intersect at A sigma and the ones that intersect at A bar sigma bar. And these surfaces are fixed by the reflection symmetries T and T bar. Okay, so it's possible to use these symmetries to write this replicated bulk action in terms of the action on just a small part of the bulk manifold. So first we use the
Why are you the assumption that lambda 1's approximately equal to lambda 2? Why would you assume that?
So I'm going to assume that that these density matrices rho 1 and rho 2 are infinitesimally close along some curve of density matrices.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm going to be constructing the purifications, so I can
Okay.
Right, but something more complex might happen when lambda 1 isn't close to lambda 2. So the replica symmetry means that the total bulk action is equal to k times the bulk action on just this one wedge, and then we can use the T bar symmetry along two of the A bars to make this even smaller. So the total action will be equal to 2k times the real part of the action on the highlighted wedge. And these T-bar and ZK here are exact symmetries, so this isn't an approximation. So we only need to consider the fields on this manifold. So to make this easier, let's identify the two sigma bars and draw the manifold in this way. So there are some things to say about the fields on the resulting manifold. First of all, the fields are discontinuous at sigma bar. And this is because there's no reason why in the replicated bulk space that the fields should be equal at the two sigma bars. Also, there's a conical defect at epsilon of opening angle pi over k. But other than that, the boundary conditions for this action are just lambda 1 and lambda 2 T star. So now let's analytically continue to k equals half so that we can get back the fidelity. So the opening angle at the conical defect becomes 2 pi, so it's actually not a conical defect anymore. But it's still important because it tells us where the boundary of sigma bar is, which is where the fields will be discontinuous. And by the standard argument of Malacena and Lukowicz, epsilon will coincide with the minimal surface homologous to A in this limit. So the field discontinuities at sigma bar are constrained by the approximate T symmetry of the replica manifold. And I won't go into the details, but this can be understood as k goes to half. So what we end up with is a path integral, or rather a bulk action on this spacetime. And the bulk action has the same boundary conditions as for the inner product between the states lambda 1 and lambda 2. And in fact, the only difference is the discontinuity in the fields at sigma bar. And we can think of this discontinuity in terms of the bulk theory as arising from some operator insertion on sigma bar. So we insert this operator, which I'll call X, into the inner product of lambda 2 and lambda 1. And it's possible to use bulk perturbation theory to construct this operator X. And in fact, the symmetries of the replica path integral are enough to ensure that this operator will be unitary. So X acts locally at sigma bar, which means that we can use the bulk reconstruction results of Dong, Harlow, and Wall to write this as an operator in the boundary theory, which takes the form of an inner product, of the identity acting on the Hilbert space of A, tensored with some unitary operator acting on the Hilbert space of A bar. So now, using all this, we're ready to define the purifications which will be parallel. So they're defined in this way. The first one is just the original version of lambda 1 before reduction. And the second one is lambda 2, but with the adjoint of this operator X applied to it. And the denominators are, again, just to normalize these states. So psi 1 is clearly a purification of rho 1. And psi 2 is the purification of rho 2 because of the form of X given on the top equation. And the inner product between these two states contains as a factor this inner product of lambda 1 and lambda 2 with X inserted. So we should be able to relate it to the fidelity. In fact, the precise relation between the two bulk actions is exactly this equality, which is precisely the one that Ullmann's theorem requires. So because we've constructed these states that obey this relationship between the fidelity and the absolute value of the inner product, we can conclude that these states are parallel. These purifications are parallel. We've constructed parallel purifications of these holographic states. So suppose now that we have some curve of boundary conditions, lambda s, we can compute the pure holographic state for the whole boundary, and then we can reduce these to A to give us a curve of density matrices. And now let's pick some density matrices ordered along this curve. And then using this construction I've described, we can find a sequence of parallel purifications. And as we take the limit, as n goes to infinity and these density matrices cover the curve, these states will converge to a parallel lift of the original curve of density matrices. So each of these xi's on the line below, on the lower half of the slide, these are operator insertions on sigma bar. So using the bulk reconstruction results, we can write them in this way. And then the Ullmann holonomy is given by the composition of all of these operators in a limit as n goes to infinity. And the result is some operator, it's unitary, it acts on H, A bar, the Hilbert space of the complement of A. So I should note that this operator contains a large amount of information about the entanglement between A and A bar. And in the rest of this talk, I'll only be talking about one part of that information. So it'd be really nice to be able to understand more about this operator. In particular, if there is no entanglement, then you can show that this operator is just the identity. So really the fact that it deviates from the identity is telling you something about the entanglement. So now we compute the Ullmann phase, the holographic Ullmann phase. And that comes from taking these purifications and computing the Barry phase along that curve, even when it's not closed. So it's not hard to compute this by using the holographic dictionary to write these correlators in terms of the bulk action. You have to be slightly careful about the final correlator. So this is the thing that could give you an imaginary part to the Ullmann phase. But you can do this again in terms of the bulk action, and you can show that in the classical limit, it doesn't give you that imaginary part. And what you find is you can write the Ullmann phase in this way. So here, phi I is the dominant bulk field configuration for lambda I, for the boundary conditions lambda I. Delta phi I is the change in field configuration between two different sets of boundary conditions. And the theta is just defined in terms of the variation of the Lagrangian, as I described at the beginning. And we should expect this theta to appear because when we compute these inner products and transition amplitudes, we're computing variations of the bulk action. Slightly more surprising maybe is that we're only integrating it over sigma and not other parts of the spacetime. And the reason this comes about is just because of some nice cancellations that occur in the computation. And these are related to the symmetries of the replica spacetime and the discontinuities at sigma bar. So now we have this expression at finite n. If we take the limit as n goes to infinity, we can replace this sum by an integral. And we see that gamma can be written as the integral around C of this form I capital theta, where capital theta is the integral of lowercase theta over sigma. So C, we can view it using the holographic map between boundary conditions and field configurations as a curve in field space. And capital theta is a one form on field space because delta phi is a vector. So the Ullmann phase really, this result is saying that the Ullmann phase is the integral of this connection A, which I times capital theta. So there's a factor of I in there, which might seem troublesome at first, but it's really just because we've done this in Euclidean space. So we really want an expression in terms of the Lorentzian fields. So to do this, we just wick rotate. And after having done so, the factor of I goes away because there's an odd number of time derivatives in theta. So here, phi Lorentzian are just the wick rotated fields in the Lorentzian spacetime. And in Lorentzian spacetime, the domain of dependence of sigma is just the entanglement wedge of A. Because, as I said, epsilon is the Ryotaki-Inagi surface, or HRT surface. And if we take if we want to find the curvature of this connection, we just take the exterior derivative of theta. But according to the covariant phase space formalism, the exterior derivative of theta is just the symplectic form of the fields in the domain of dependence of sigma. So it's the symplectic form of the entanglement wedge. So from that, we get the main result of the talk, which is that the curvature of the Ullmann phase is holographically dual to the symplectic form of the entanglement wedge. Okay, so let me give some comments. So if we let the boundary subregion A contain the entire boundary, then the entanglement wedge contains all of the bulk, or at least the part of it behind a black hole. Well, there's recent stuff about that I won't. And the Ullmann phase reduces to the Berry phase because the states in A are pure. So we recover the result of Belin, Lukowicz, and Sarosi, that the Berry curvature of these states is dual to the whole bulk symplectic form. And so it's an accurate characterization to say that this is a generalization of that result. So another comment, this result really says that classical bulk subregion physics, or at least Poisson brackets in the subregion, emerges in measurements of the Ullmann phase. And the Ullmann phase is a genuine observable for any quantum system. So this first group of people, they described an experiment that you could do that could measure it. And then the second group of people, I think they showed that, or they did this experiment, or at least they simulated this experiment for some simple system and showed that it works. I'm unaware of an actual unsimulated experiment that's measured this thing, but in principle, it's an observable.
Wait, can I ask, does that mean it's like
yes,
an operator, or isn't it observable like the entanglement entropy might be an observable?
So I don't think it's an operator. I think.
Okay, so just.
I think maybe it's an observable in the sense that the entanglement entropy is. I think the experiment they describe involves lots of repeated measurements. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure how they describe it. So yeah, it'd be useful to understand more details of what's going on here. So in this talk, I considered states built on the vacuum, but you can pick more general base states to insert your sources on, and the same argument works, so long as those states are prepared by some Euclidean path integral. So for example, we could pick the thermofield double in two copies of the CFT, and this you can prepare by doing a Euclidean path integral on a sphere times an interval, and it corresponds to a black hole in the bulk. So the results I've presented apply to the case of black holes also. So something important that I haven't mentioned yet is that the covariant phase space formalism is actually ambiguous. And this is because this form theta is only defined up to the addition of some exact form. And if we carry out this change, then capital theta changes by a contribution at the boundary of sigma. But the Ullmann phase itself is unambiguous. And in fact, I haven't described exactly what happens, but the way this calculation happens, you find some concrete condition on theta that fixes this ambiguity. And I can say a little bit about that if someone asks a question. But it'd be good to understand better the implications of how that works. Something slightly odd that I've avoided talking about is that it's quite natural to expect there to be a classical limit in which pure states give a classical phase space. But it's less clear that the same should be true of mixed states. In particular, we might expect not to get classical states back, but maybe probability distributions of classical states. But for the holographic states we've considered here, clearly this does happen. We get just single states in the classical phase space. And why is this? This is something I'd like to understand. Maybe more intriguing, or also intriguing, is that now that we have a phase space for a subregion, we can run this whole thing backwards and try and quantize that phase space. So the result of this would presumably be some formulation of pure states in subregions. And obviously this is slightly unusual, because usually we expect the state in a subregion to always be mixed. So I'd like to explore this and sort of understand what it means to have a pure state in a subregion. So here are some other future directions, perhaps, or things I want to understand. So this result is for Einstein gravity with other fields as well. And it's at leading order in one over n. So it'd be useful to understand these three types of corrections. There are high derivative corrections that mean you're not looking just at the minimal area surface, but the minimum of some other functional. And there are quantum corrections coming from one over n corrections. And there are also statistical corrections, because the Ullmann parallelity assumption is a statistical one. Also, Belin, Lukwicz, and Sarossi, they had a follow-up paper where they used their result to explore holographic complexity, and it'd be useful to see if I could, or if it could be applied to this, or if the tools I've given here could be applied in that context to understand subregion complexity. Also, I'd like to understand the interplay with holographic renormalization, where the insertion of boundary operators is how that fits in. I'd also like to understand if there are connections with modular theory. So the fact that the minimal area surface appears in this sort of suggests that there might be something to do with that. And there are results which sort of compute another type of connection for density matrices in subregions called the modular Berry connection. And I'd like to know if there's some way in which this work and that work fits together. More speculatively, I'd like to see if this could work in combination with recent ideas about replica wormholes, where the entanglement wedge sort of extends inside the horizon or goes behind the horizon. And also, there have been suggestions that the Ullmann phase can be used to classify condensed matter phases, and it'd be cool to see if we could use my results in the holographic context there. Okay, thank you for listening. So, sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Really shallow.
Yeah.
So in a simple words, my question is gravitational shockwaves out of time ordered correlator, these overlap of two states. Can I view it as a very curvature or a Luhmann phase?
Sorry, again, the audio is a bit.
So let's think about two states. One is geometric gravitational shockwave in one direction, and then the other one is in the other direction. And then the overlap is basically out of time order correlation function. So is this idea related to Berry curvature or Berry phase?
I'm not sure. So So I assume, so long as we can compute the correlators in terms of bulk actions, and there's some classical Poisson brackets relating these two things, then it must be related to the Berry phase. But I'm not sure I can say anything else.
Okay.
Could you comment briefly on how the ambiguity in theta is getting resolved? And is it sort of the same way that it just like what's happening in the Lugwick all the theta or the Dong version of that? Or is there any new insight on what's going on there?
So I have sort of an implicit equation that should resolve the ambiguity. I don't fully understand it, but I have an extra slide that describes it. So on this space-time where there's these discontinuous fields, so we consider a field variation, call it delta tilde phi, that obeys these boundary conditions minus delta lambda in the past and delta lambda t star in the future. But it also has the property that it changes sign when it crosses sigma bar. And then in my paper, I show that if you enforce this condition, that the integral of theta around the minimal surface goes to zero when you compute it on this delta tilde phi, then this resolves the ambiguity, and it's actually the one that the Ullmann phase wants you to enforce. This is some equation that in principle resolves the ambiguity, but I haven't yet computed it in any, for instance, just in Einstein gravity, I haven't computed what effect this has on theta itself. But I'd like to obviously be able to do that. I don't understand any more than just this condition needs to hold.
Okay. Any other final questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Josh again.